Good afternoon and welcome to St. Peter's Barge. Very warm welcome on a very cold day. Well done for making it across here. Do grab a seat if you can and fill up the spaces. Do munch away through the lunchtime. I know lots of us are on tight schedules, so use the time to eat your packed lunch. As some of you may know, we've started here on the barge occasional meetings called One Thing in Common, where we invite people who with very different backgrounds. We've had an ex-terrorist, a sportsman, but all the people have one thing in common, as the headline suggests, the one thing in common being their faith in Jesus Christ. Gives us a chance to interview them, see how their faith has impacted their life. Today we've got, we're very glad to have Sir Jeremy Cook. He's a High Court judge with us. I'm going to interview him, and then he's agreed to speak to us on the topic of rough justice. After that, we'll certainly all be wrapped up and out by 1:45 for those who have got 2 o'clocks. So can I introduce and welcome up Sir Jeremy? Do you join me?
Thank you.
I probably should reveal that if I'm slightly over-familiar with Jeremy, it is because we have met before, haven't we?
Once or twice.
We have, but you'll be glad to know, not in court. I've never been up before him, never had looking over the glasses. The first time I met Jeremy, I was trying to persuade his youngest daughter to marry me. Who agreed, and, well, after he'd agreed that I could ask her. So apart from my relationship with God, Josie's the next most precious thing, so I'm very grateful to Jeremy for giving me the... such a precious thing in Josie. Now, Jeremy's come to us today from the Royal Courts of Justice, closed the courts, come across. So we're very grateful he's taken the time to be with us. Jeremy, you would normally be in a case right now trying something. It's something lots of us won't have experienced except perhaps on TV. Some of us will have come from jobs this morning slightly less glamorous, and we've seen, you know, the wigs, the hammers. How does one get to, if we're thinking of a change of career, how does one get to be in your position? How did you get to be a High Court judge?
Well, it's all a little different now from when I became a judge, because there now is a process where you actually apply for the job. 10 years ago, when I was appointed, you got a phone call from the Lord Chancellor.
Okay.
And you knew you were either going to be disbarred or asked to become a judge. These days, barristers and solicitors apply for the job, and there's a very transparent process with a committee that looks at it all.
Okay.
And you fill in a form saying how wonderful you are, and get interviewed, and so they reach decisions.
Yeah. So there's Peter Cook, the comedian, who I assume is no relation. He said he wanted to be, there's a quip where he said, I wanted to be a High Court judge rather than a coal miner because of the absence of falling coal, but I didn't have the Latin. So it's not all just to do with the Latin.
It's not all to do with the Latin.
Okay. No. And you've been involved, you've been a judge for 10 years. You've been involved in some high-profile cases, which we'll have read about in the papers. Most recently, just before Christmas, the Pakistan match-fixing trial. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, I guess every... little boy's dream is having a job where you get to watch clips of cricket all day long on the TV. Is that what it was like? Tell us about your reflections on the trial.
Well, we had to watch the particular no balls time and again, and indeed bits around it. And before the thing came on, I said to counsel, we are going to have to watch a lot of cricket, aren't we? Can we have a site visit, I suggested. But that wasn't allowed. Okay. But... I mean, one's reflections on it is that, I mean, it's a very, very sad thing. You know, the integrity of the game was jeopardised. People wonder now whether anything they see is for real. And that's the difficulty with it. And it matters. You know, it was all about betting scandals and so on. But nonetheless, in games, as everywhere else, integrity matters.
Yeah. Well, it's glad that a strong message has been sent out. And I guess it's having an impact on cricket today, isn't it?
Well, I think if England are going to win, I'd have to lock up another 12 Pakistanis, wouldn't I? So, there we are.
It's something we could consider. Perhaps perhaps before the next series, we should think a bit more about that. The year before that, you were involved in another high-profile case, which was the stabbing of the MP, Stephen Timms. Now, Stephen Timms was stabbed by a lady who did the stabbing in the name of Allah. She's a fundamentalist Muslim. And you made a public statement at that time contrasting his Christian faith with her faith. How would you say those two are contrasted, if they are?
Well, there's no doubt that the girl in question, she was, she read a lot of material on the internet, essentially. There's some doubt as to whether, in fact, there was more than that. But the evidence was that she had effectively studied Islamic scholars on the internet, and the material was produced, and I saw it. And it quite clearly advocated violence and assassination and the like. And she'd taken that on board. The contrast that I was drawing was that on the one hand and Jesus' teaching on the other. Love God, love your neighbour, love your enemy, love the alien who lives in your country, and so on. And that was the message I was trying to get across, was that the two are so obviously contrasted. And her attitude is one that civilization won't tolerate.
Yeah, thank you. Now, your verdict there wasn't popular in the court, so I wasn't present, but there were cries of curse the judge from the gallery. On other occasions, I think I'm right in saying even the trial just before Christmas, effigies have been made of you and burnt, and that's happened on more than one occasion in different countries. Now, I guess not many of us have that sort of opposition in our day-to-day lives, in our jobs. I may be wrong, but how do you cope with that? How does your faith impact on that?
Well, as a judge, you're there to do justice, and it's inevitable that some people won't like justice. Whenever you decide a case, most of my work is actually commercial work, so I actually decide between litigating parties, and invariably one of them is not going to be pleased with the result. But my job is to do justice. That's what I feel I'm called to do. And that's the consequence. I've been burnt in effigy in Lewis on bonfire night. I've been burnt in effigy in Pakistan, along, in fact, with some of the cricketers whose effigies were burnt. But as long as they don't burn me personally, in the end, I'm not too concerned.
Okay, yeah, I'd certainly draw the line at that stage. Thank you. And we mentioned on the publicity, you're a keen rugby fan, so you used to play for your university, Oxford University, and I'm told that was back in the days when an Oxford side could actually beat an international, and you beat the Springboks. There's some South Africans here today who will be upset about that, but is it right if you beat a Springbok touring side, you actually get to keep a Springbok head, not one of the players, I assume?
No, they used to, I don't know if they still do, but they used to bring a Springbok head on tour.
Okay.
And the first team that beat them was given the head, which then goes up on the wall in the clubhouse.
Okay, so it's not in your living room.
It's not in my living room, no, it's at Vincent's Club in Oxford.
Okay, and then after... Well, tell us a little bit about that. What was it like playing rugby for the Blues back in those days?
Well, of course, it was a slightly different world. The game was an amateur game, and the university then, we'd play and beat most of the first-class clubs, and indeed, as you say, we beat an international side, which is just not feasible these days at all. It was a lot of fun because you were playing with guys you knew really well, intelligent people with whom you had a... Well, at least they like to think they were intelligent. People you had a lot in common with. And I had the most fun playing there that I ever had, yeah. I guess, really, playing. Yeah.
And you kept up playing, so you went on to play for the Harlequins. I guess lots of us know rugby clubs are not... tend to be very macho environments, not an easy place, perhaps, for a Christian man. How did you respond? How did you react in those kind of environments?
Well, it's... like many all-male environments, there was at that time certainly a heavy drinking culture and womanizing and so on. And as a Christian, well, you have to know where you draw the line. Make your position plain from the start. That's what I sought to do. You take a bit of stick for it. There's no question about that. People think you're a bit odd. You probably are. But not for that reason. And you stand for what you believe. It's as simple as that, really.
Yeah, thank you. Now, you were a Christian long before that. I think you were persuaded of the Christian faith growing up and as a teenager particularly. Now, a lot of people might think that's a little bit curious. For a rational, analytical person, having a faith in Jesus, has that meant you basically had to throw your brain away? I mean, you believe in miracles, you believe in people rising from the dead. How do you square that with being a rational person, you know, analytical, intelligent person?
Well, it's up to others to say whether I'm a rational, intelligent person, but I certainly don't think faith involves irrationality. I think Christianity presents the most coherent worldview, and one has to explain the universe as it is, life as it is, people as they are, values, all the gamut of life. And to my mind, it's an entirely rational position to hold. And once you've come to that conclusion, then to put your faith in the God who lies behind it and in Jesus. And the evidence for Jesus' historicity and resurrection is very strong indeed. It makes perfect sense.
And speaking personally, were you looking at the evidence for the resurrection? Was that what drew you in, or what was it that caught your attention about Jesus?
Well, I think in my teenage years, the thing that caught my attention above all was other Christians and the way they lived and their devotion to Christ, because it seemed to me that if what they believed was true, and I thought it was, then the model they gave, that this is something you live by and that affects all your life, that was very powerful in its impact on me at the age of about 14 or 15. I'm talking about people who were in the age group 17 to 25, basically, people that little bit older, and I could see just what it meant to them, and that was a great example.
Yeah. So it was, in some way, it was persuasive of the truth of it, and also, did you find it an attractive?
Yes, the way these people lived it out. Yeah. That was very attractive. Yeah.
And I guess that will impact how you have gone on to live as a Christian in the workplace, those early examples. Now, I guess there will be Christian people in this room for whom being a Christian at work is a challenge, both being useful for Jesus and being faithful to Jesus. What would you say from your experience of the workplace? What advice would you give people who are in that situation trying to work out how to be a Christian at work?
I think that the fundamental thing is to see your work as being done as service for God. That's a thing I feel very strongly about. And it doesn't matter what it is. It may be easier to see if you're a judge and dishing out justice, supposedly. But the Bible's very clear that in your work you serve God just as you do when you're praying, worshipping, whatever. And if you take that attitude into work, it makes a huge difference. You pray about your work, you pray about the people you're going to meet, you pray about doing the job well and honouring God in it and pleasing him in it. And the other great thing is to meet with other Christians and gain all the support and encouragement you can in your workplace. If there are other Christians, get together and pray with them once a week or whatever. Certainly I used to do that when I was at the bar.
Yeah, and have you found with the support of Christians in the workplace, it's a place where you can actually get to speak about your faith?
Oh, yes, and indeed pray for people. And it's rather odd that people who don't believe are very happy generally that you should pray for them. If they have a problem, they'd know to come up to you, and they'd know there'd be a group of three people who'd be meeting on a regular basis to pray for them and their needs. So, yes. And opportunities obviously come up then to invite them to things of this kind.
Yeah.
And indeed to speak to them directly about what it means to be a Christian.
Yeah. And I guess being in London, you had the advantage there were lunchtime.
Absolutely, all over London. Yeah. Even in those days, there were were services, there were places that you could take people to. I mean, it's the great advantage of a place like this, isn't it, that you've got people coming from all over London, beyond, out in the suburbs, but they're here, and people are working, what, 70% of their waking lives. You've got an opportunity to meet them and draw them in. Yeah,
thank you. Well, I didn't want to leave us time to hear Jeremy speak to us. He's agreed to speak to us on the topic of rough justice. So I'm going to hand over, and Jeremy is going to speak to us, and then we'll draw things to a close a little later on. So thank you, Jeremy. I'll grab a lectern.
A successful tycoon was suffering from depression, and he felt he'd lost his business flair. He found it difficult to make decisions anymore, and so he went to his GP for a checkup. The GP referred him to a brain specialist, being a tycoon, privately, of course, not on the NHS. But there he was told he was suffering from burnout. His brain was prematurely old and worn out, but not to worry, with modern brain transplant surgery, he could soon have a new one. He asked about the cost, and he was told that it all depended on what type of brain he wanted. They were a bit short of supply at the time, but there seemed to be some spare legal brains around from overworked lawyers who died young at their desks. So he was told you can have a junior barrister's brain for £30,000, you can have a Queen's Counsel's brain for £50,000, or you can have a judge's brain for £200,000. £200,000? That's absurd, said the tycoon. A judge's brain can't be worth four times that of a Queen's Counsel. Oh, yes, it can, came the reply. You see, it's as good as new. It's hardly ever been used. Many people think that judges need brain transplants, and many people think that Christians need brain transplants. The tabloids all think that judges need brain transplants because they let offenders off too lightly, and they don't do justice so far as the victims are concerned. And many people share that concern. Other people think that Christians need brain transplants because they suggest that God is going to hold us to account and judge the world and punish wrongdoing. So you've got two conflicting ideas here, haven't you? Judges should punish more. God shouldn't punish at all. And yet, inbuilt in all of us, there is this sense of justice. It is absolutely innate in us, isn't it? What's the child's earliest complaint? It's not fair. Usually, of course, when it's a grievance of his or hers. But it does go a bit beyond the personal, because all children also want games to be played by the rules too, don't they? They want fairness. And when you hear of some significant crime, whether it's murder or paedophilia, you instinctively want something to be done about it. You know it cannot be left as it is. And we think in terms, don't we, of putting it right, of reparation, of compensation, of payment for the crime committed, of balancing the scales, some sort of equivalence of justice. And the Christian suggestion for the reason for that is this. It's because we're made in the image of a God, part of whose character is justice. And when we're faced, however, with the idea of God doing justice and judging, we balk at it. Now, here's another oddity. People often say, if there's a God, then why doesn't he do something about all the injustice and the unfairness and the wrongdoing and the evil in the world? Why doesn't he stop the genocide that's going on? Why doesn't he stop all the murders and the rapes and all that kind of thing? And they use that then as an argument for not putting their trust in God or for not believing in him. And inbuilt in that is a recognition, you see, that a good and just God really ought to do something about evil. It's impossible, isn't it, to conceive of a good God who, without more, would treat Adolf Hitler and Mother Teresa in exactly the same way. And the idea that God's untroubled by serial murders or genocide or by paedophilia, it's unthinkable, isn't it? What would you think about of a God who either saw no difference between good and evil or did nothing about it? Surely he must do something. We know it instinctively. It's inevitable, isn't it, that a just God, a good God, will do justice and, unlike human judges, get it absolutely right. Our justice is rough and ready, and we get it wrong from time to time. But God's justice will be perfect. You see, Jesus told a story. He told a story about a bad judge, often described as an unjust judge. And this man was self-contained. He didn't fear God. He didn't care what other people thought about him. He was hard-bitten. He was cynical. And he was just seeing out his time on the bench until he could take up his index-linked pension, albeit now with a greater contribution than it used to have. There was a widow in the town, and she had been defrauded. And she kept making applications to him to get her case on. But he did nothing about it. He couldn't be bothered with a litigant in person and did nothing at all. But she kept coming to him and demanding justice, that eventually he got so fed up with her continual applications and he said to himself something of this kind: I don't care about God. I don't care about truth. I don't care about justice. I don't care about humanity. I don't care what the Ministry of Justice or the Lord Chief Justice think of me. But this woman, she just keeps pestering me, and I'm not going to get any peace until I deal with her case. So he has the case listed, and he's shamed into doing justice. And she's vindicated. And Jesus said, if that's what a corrupt judge does, you can be absolutely certain that God will ultimately bring about justice. But he doesn't do so now, does he? And people complain at that when they see the consequences of evil and suffering in humanity. Why doesn't he do something to stop it? And then I ask the question, well, what is it that you actually want God to do? Do you want him to stop people making choices about what they do? Do you want him to eliminate evil? And if so, what evil? All evil? All wrongdoing? Or just the worst cases, the worst crimes, the worst criminals as you see them? Or some intermediate level between all evil and the worst evil as you see it? Or perhaps you just really, like the little child, want him to sort out the wrongs that are done to you or to those you know, those close to you, those you identify with, but leave out of the question any evil, any wrongdoing in which you're concerned. The things that we've done to others. Destroy the evil in others, that's fine. But leave my little failings, and they are little, out of it. Well, that doesn't sound very moral or very just, does it? Another thing Jesus said was this. He said, out of the heart come evil thoughts, theft, murder, immorality, malice, greed, deceit, envy, arrogance, lies, and slander. You see, what he's saying is this, that crime, murder, and theft has the same root cause as all the other things that we see as wrong, but regard as much less serious. And elsewhere, he points out that the person who's angry has the same root problem as the person who murders. And the man who's jealous or envious and covets what others have has the same root problem as the person who steals. Murder and theft have the same root cause as these other issues. So there may be various different types of wrong crime and wrongdoing, but the root cause ultimately isn't very difficult to spot, is it? It can be very simply indeed. It's this. It's our tendency to do what we want, even if it damages other people. And we all suffer from that syndrome, don't we? But justice requires it to be dealt with. What about the way we treat God? What should a just God do about those who refuse to treat him as God? The God who wants us to serve him in a father-son, father-child relationship of trust and obedience? What does a state do with those who commit rebellion or treason? What can a father do about a son who walks out, rejects him as father, and says he doesn't want to have anything to do with him? The requirements of both justice and of personal relationships mean that there are consequences, whether it be punishment or exile, separation, alienation, whatever. And Jesus made it clear, didn't he, that God's law can be summed up in two great tenets. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength, all of you, everything we have directed towards loving God. And then to love other people in the same way as we care for ourselves. And we don't. We find we can't, even if we try. And that's even before we start taking seriously the command to love our enemies. Whether we like it or not, we're rebels because we don't submit to God or his ways. In truth, we don't really want to be ruled by God. We want to be autonomous. We want to be independent. To live independently of the God who made us and claims our loyalty. And so we don't fulfill those commandments. Some years ago, my son, now adult, possibly growing out of it, but he then used to follow a band called Fun Loving Criminals. I don't know if anybody remembers them. But I think we often see ourselves as a bit like that. Fun-loving criminals. We don't see it really as very serious that we don't treat God as God. And we don't think there's anything really too much wrong with ourselves. But I come back to that question. Where does a just God draw the line in levels of disregard of him and levels of selfishness and evil? What lies at the heart of the criminal mind lies at the heart of us all. In our minds, in our wills, in our attitudes. We don't truly allow God to be God in our lives. As the little aphorism has it, the heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. And if we are fun-loving criminals in our own eyes, even we are admitting to ourselves we are part of the problem of evil that has to be sorted out. And there's here both a problem of justice and a problem of relationships. Justice requires some balancing of the scales, whilst the relationship requires a father's forgiveness and restoration as the child comes back to his or her father. How can that be sorted? A Frenchman introduced himself to an Englishman. "Hello," he said. Why, as he was French. "Bonjour. Bonjour, je m'appelle Déjà Vu." "My name is Déjà Vu." To which the Englishman replied, "Haven't we met somewhere before?" God's solution to the problem is the cross. And we all have this sort of Déjà Vu notion, a shadowy idea, perhaps, of what the cross is about. But what the cross tells us is this. That only God can put right this issue that arises between us and him. God's answer to the problem is a remarkable one. It's this. He meets his own justice himself. He achieves justice not by eliminating evil here and now, but by sending his son, who suffers the penalty of all crime and wrongdoing himself, on the cross. The act of crucifying Jesus is perhaps the epitome, isn't it, of all wrongdoing. It's the ultimate attempt to do away with God, to be independent of him, to kill God. But that very act is God's solution to the problem. It's absolutely unthinkable in human society that the head of state or the judge should meet the demands of justice for the crime instead of the criminal. But that is exactly what the message of the cross is about. A God who cannot tolerate evil, who must do something about it, himself suffers the injustice of man by taking human form and dying as if he was the criminal, the wrongdoer. He deliberately, and you only have to read the Gospels to see this, Jesus deliberately goes to the cross and lets men murder him through corrupt processes of justice, unjust punishment, and takes on himself the evil of the world and its consequences. And then the Father can welcome the prodigal son home with forgiveness and restoration and joyful celebration because God's Son has taken the blame. I finish with this. One of Jesus' followers, Peter, explains in a letter why it is that God doesn't eliminate evil and sort the problem out here and now. He says it's to give people a chance of coming home. He says God offers a pardon in Jesus, rehabilitation with his Spirit for those who will come home to him, to those who decide to follow Jesus. And so there's a choice. Human justice is rough. I entitled this talk Rough Justice for that reason. Human justice is rough. God's justice is perfect and will surely come. But his solution is perfect too, if we will simply avail ourselves of it and make that choice to align ourselves with Jesus, to take his pardon and turn back to him and come home to the Father. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.